Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey met in the mid-60s. At the time, Morrissey was an insurance clerk and film buff who made short silent films on the side. Morrissey went to work as the assistant on Warhol's films. A couple of years later, Warhol gave up directing for producing, and Paul Morrissey took over the writing and directing of the films. Three of those films, Trash, Flesh, and Heat, have just been released on home video. These are underground film comedies. They were crudely made with improvised dialogue and the kind of subject matter that couldn't have come out of Hollywood at the time. The characters were oddballs and misfits who all had explicit sex on camera. In the mid-70s, Warhol produced Morrissey's comic versions of Frankenstein and Dracula. In 1984, Morrissey made Mixed Blood, a film set in the abandoned buildings in Lower Manhattan that were taken over by drug dealers. Morrissey co-wrote and directed a new film, which opens this week. It's called Beethoven's Nephew, and it presents Beethoven as a great composer, but a miserable human being. I spoke with Paul Morrissey from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we talked about his new film, we discussed his underground film days. Here's an excerpt from Heat.
Okay.
I'll get it. Hello? Who's this? Bonnie? Bonnie, listen. I didn't do anything. Listen, you just came over here with me to my mother's house. Listen, I'm coming right home. Don't you dare take the pills. Listen to me. You need me more than the pills. Oh, go on, for God's sake. Listen, don't you dare touch those pills. Stay away from them. No, no, I'm not doing anything with him. Just listen, Bonnie, listen to me. It's Jessica. Listen, wake up. Wake up!
You started making movies at a time when independent filmmaking was still really in its infancy. Was it a real exciting notion to you that you could just, you know, pick up a camera yourself and make your own movies, that you didn't have to go to Hollywood, you didn't have to do a major motion picture to make a film?
Yes, you're exactly right. It was very exciting to think you could do that. And you could do that then, but you can't do that now. In fact, I think it was never done before or since. It was, in that sense, an almost unique period. These films were made for unbelievably low costs. Even today, I won't even say what they cost. And that they traveled to every city in the world. Europe, France, in Paris, in London, in Munich, in Berlin. They went to Spain. They went all over the place. And they traveled throughout the United States. These films were made by myself and a person on the sound. They were not made by 4 people or 30 people or 80 people. They were entirely made by me. I photographed them. I wrote them. I told the actors what to do. I edited them. I made up the ad. And then I got the distributor to put them into theaters. I even made up the contracts for the distribution agreements. I still own these films with the Andy Warhol estate. It's a 50-50 arrangement. The films were made, financed by Andy, made by me, and we would divide any profits. They were so inexpensive, the profits came in very quickly. This type of filmmaking, totally independent of everybody, I didn't have to deal with other members of the crew. There was no crew. There was a person on the sound, and I was on the camera. Was really unique, and I think these films that have come out on video, people today see them, they still look very fresh, I think, because there's nothing quite like them ever happened again. They were made so totally independent of anybody. So whenever I see my films, I see myself making decisions as to what's funny, who is funny, who should be in front of the camera, how the story should go. The things that are not in the story are more noticeable than what's there. I avoid melodrama, I avoid car chases, I have no killings, I have no violence, I have humor, and I hope. And that humor, if it gets a laugh at one point, it somehow is able, I think, to get a laugh later on. But the interest, on top of the humor, you want also some sort of slight little feeling of, let's say, sympathy for the people, too.
Did you ever think when you were making them that Trash, Flesh, and Heat would end up being available for home viewing?
Oh, well, yeah, I guess no reason why not. There was nothing, terribly shocking about them. They just had little nudity scenes and things like that, but The films were all comedies, and, you know, my attitude now is never, was no different then. These sequences of people getting involved with some sort of foolish drugs or sex or any of the sort of fads of the 60s, all those horrible, you know, never now become institutions and establishment institutions today, they always seem to be foolish and a wonderful source of the comedy and the foolishness of people. And they were done never in any serious vein. The movies were serious. All comedies, I think, can be serious if they're meant to be. And I think comedy is a very serious business. But the individual things that people thought were a little bit shocking were usually, almost always, in my case, things that were the biggest laughs.
Well, it's funny, some of the scenes are almost anti-erotic in the sense that they're about people too bored or too wasted to even get sexually aroused enough to have sex.
Well, you're just noticing that now 20 years later. People didn't seem to pay attention to that before, although it's so totally obvious. I think they were totally anti-erotic. I think eroticism in movies is a hoot. It's totally ridiculous. It was then, it was before, and it's worse now. It's just the stupidest thing in the world. Now, many years later, people are even leaving it out, thank God. But when it rears its stupid head, in movies still, and people huff and puff and heavy breathe and go into clinches and roll around on mattresses with the clothes off, it's ridiculous. And it was then, and God knows I never did it seriously.
Even though you saw your films as anti-erotic, did nevertheless some people come to your movies as if they were porn movies, you know, just to see naked people?
I suppose some people do, sure. Who knows? You know, the media invents a kind of category for things, and you never know how people interpret them. Their impressions of things come less from what they see than from what they're told to look for.
Did you ever have trouble finding places to screen your early movies because of the nudity?
No, not at all. No, we made a lot of experimental in the sense of experimental to us. They weren't experimental in their nature. They were very simple. But they were tests for our sketches. Mm-hmm. And they weren't, lively enough to be shown all over. So we just showed them in one little tiny theater in New York for ourselves, really. See if there's any audience reaction. No, those films, those three films that are out of video, were shown all over the world and every city and the big cities and everything.
Did you see those early movies as a reaction against a certain pretentiousness in movies?
Yes, certainly that kind of film is a reaction against pretentiousness, but a pretentiousness in life. You know, the hippie thing is not really something really looked down upon and laughed at. It's something that's become the establishment now. Bruce Springsteen is considered some sort of, genius on a scale with Beethoven or somebody. I mean, this is, to me, ludicrous. But he's the same old screaming rock and roll act that's been around for 20, 25 years. And now it's taken deadly seriously. Then it was beginning to be taken seriously. I think those attitudes, the tone of voice of those people screaming their lungs out with some message for the youth of the nation are very funny and silly and fatuous and pretentious. And so they were reactions against the pretensions of the period.
Director Paul Morrissey is my guest, and three of his films, Heat, Flesh, and Trash, have just been released on home video, and he has a new movie called Beethoven's Nephew, which will have its theatrical premiere in the United States this week. Do you love the glamour of Hollywood films?
Well, you mean the glamour that once existed in Hollywood?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, of the earlier
Hollywood
films. I
don't love it. I think it was a wonderful idea, and it was very entertaining, and it was a good idea, and it was an unpretentious idea. There is no glamour today, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of pretension. You either the movies today are either veer between total childishness, you know, aimed at 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds. Of course, getting the entire yuppie market, that's sort of the age level. Or they're unbelievably pretentious. There's no sort of continuous kind of light, vaguely, if you want to use the word sophisticated, tone of voice left in movies.
Well, I asked you about glamour because I figured you probably liked the earlier Hollywood films. Yet, your movies are kind of anti-glamour in a lot of ways. Instead of being larger than life, the early movies are like more flat than real life in a way.
Well, I think they were more realistic than other movies, but at the same time, I wanted to have an antidote to that realism at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what I tried to do always, when I told these very realistic stories, which I knew I could tell because nobody else was telling them in a way, so it was a vacuum, as it were, I would always cast them with the most inappropriate people to be found in these situations, people who looked better than they looked in Hollywood in the 30s and 40s. In other words, I always used idealized people to play the most realistic situations. So it wasn't glamour, but, I mean, I prefer the link to a theatrical past that doesn't go around saying, look how realistic we are, because I think that's a phony pretense also to claim realism, realism, realism. So,
in your early movies, you really didn't use trained actors. Why not?
If the part called for an actor who had some training, or, well, what do you mean training? I don't think there's such a thing as a trained actor. It's like a trained SEAL.
Well, there is. I mean, a lot of actors go to acting school and start off, you know,
no good actors
on the stage before making movies.
Well,
you have had a lot
acting,
of experience
acting,
before starting.
That's called experience acting. Trained actors, somehow this idea of coming from these unbelievable acting schools. I just finished this wonderful autobiography by Ely Kazan, who invented and started the Actors Studio.
Mm-hmm.
And pages and pages of the book are his disgust with what's come out of acting schools. And he talks about, he says, there's a sentence in the book I really like. He said, when I hear about these actors going to a master class, he said, I want to vomit. Well, it's been a horror, what's happened. He quotes Stella Adler, this remark, who was an acting teacher. When Lee Strasberg died, she said, American acting has been, the damage he caused to American acting will take 100 years to repair. And there was in New York, by the time we were making films, certainly, and certainly continues, this ridiculous industry of people attending classes and working on their private emotions and private moments and totally killing any life that possibly could come out of the actor, the performer, through these horrible classes and training, so-called training exercises. And they're artificial, they're mannered, they're phony, and they're boring.
How did you cast people for your early movies?
If they were not boring.
On the screen or off the screen? It sometimes
doesn't. No, on the screen. Very many interesting people in front of a camera are not interesting off camera, but that's just the way it is. You know, you cast somebody who has an effect on camera. You have to recognize what will have an effect on camera.
Were you sometimes interested in casting people who were interested in movies and in glamour in a way, but were really misfits kind of themselves?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I was interested in casting people that I thought would make the story work. I was interested in characters. I was creating the characters. I was making the characters up. And when you work in films in this way, and you don't write the character like Dickens wrote a character, Jane Austen wrote a character. If you don't write that kind of character, you embellish the character with the personality traits of the performer.
How did you start working on films with Andy Warhol?
Oh, Andy had seen some little tests I had done, little things, and I'd seen some things he had done, and he said, well, I like to film something every week, which was very unusual, very extravagant in those days, and he said, I have a sound camera now, and I need help, and if you're not doing anything, come around. Well, you can help me push the button on the camera. That was it.
His early films were films, you know, of like one shot for 12 hours or so.
Not really, no. That's one film,
one
or maybe
film, yeah.
Two films.
Were you
and
into that
one,
kind of stuff?
That's the one journalists like to mention endlessly, 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 endlessly. But, you know, there were maybe 300 others beside that, and they don't get mentioned so much. So he did that so that journalists would mention it and pay attention to him, because he started from nowhere. And it was a very clever move, because here, 20 years later, people still mention the one that doesn't move.
You started off as Warhol's assistant, then you ended up directing all the films, and he produced them. Did you ever feel, you know, his name was so attached to some of the movies, some people thought that they were his instead of yours? Did that ever trouble you?
They were listed correctly in the ads. Andy Warhol presents
right.
Such and such, 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 written, photographed, and directed by me. If journalists who don't pay much attention to things want to be confused
about it. I'm not talking
about
journalists. I'm talking about people in general.
That's what happened. That's what happened. Journalists would spread this idea that they were Andy's films. Just people in general. You'd be surprised. If Andy didn't spread it, the ads in the paper were correctly, listed. Andy Warhol presents. But, you know, he was a celebrity name, and journalism lives or dies on celebrity value.
Were you into the party scene yourself?
Party scene, no. No, I rather hated it. There was Andy in the art world and everything. He had enormous masochistic streak in him where he went to a party every night, it seems. You don't know how he did it, how he was able to do it, but he didn't expend much energy when he went there because he went there and sat there like a wallflower. He was really very shy, and he never participated in anything. So he felt it was important for his name to be out there and be a part of the scene. And he really dedicated himself to it very... he was going out every night of his life till the day he died, I think, the day he went to the hospital. But, you know, that was his thing. I don't enjoy it. I never knew anyone who enjoyed it. But I don't think he enjoyed it, but he did it.
How did you part with him, stop making movies with him?
Well, producers asked me to make bigger films, budget films, and they were putting up the money, so there was no reason for Andy to put in any money or participate.
Mm-hmm.
Andy didn't want to finance the films anymore because they became a little more expensive than he was able to finance. Plus, he got very busy doing his art. There was a slump during that period. Not a slump, but around the period I went off to write scripts for other people and things like that, he got extremely busy in his art business.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you about a new movie. You've got a new movie that opens this week called Beethoven's Nephew. But before we get to it, we're going to take a short break. My guest is director Paul Morrissey. Three of his films, Heat, Flesh, and Trash, all produced by Andy Warhol, have just been released on home video. And his new film, Beethoven's Nephew, opens this week. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Director Paul Morrissey is my guest. Since the movies of yours that I had been familiar with, you know, your underground films, horror films, a film about shooting galleries in New York, you know, drug shooting galleries.
Yeah.
The Beethoven's Nephew seemed like such an improbable subject for you to take on for a film.
I don't think any filmmaker finds any subject improbable, you know. Perhaps, you know, I've been identified more with contemporary settings, I suppose, but Frankenstein and Dracula were costume comedies. But this was simply a biographical film about, I thought, a very interesting character, a man of extraordinary gifts and talents who was almost in proportion, lacking any gifts or talents in real life. He was his life is such a sad.
You're talking about Beethoven himself, not the
yes, yeah. yeah. The life of Beethoven, once you get involved in reading about it, is unbelievably. I hate to use the word pathetic because it sounds like I'm patronizing him or something, but he was a man who was closed off from human contact with other people through a bitter, nasty, hostile personality. That, of course, to start out in life as a person like that and then become very famous and very money crazy and everything, rather disreputable in his dealings with people regarding money, he then goes deaf. And from the age of 23 to 57, he spends his most of his life unable to hear the music he's writing. He mistrusted and disliked people, and his mistrust and dislike of people escalated to such an extent with the deafness that it's an extraordinary story that he was able to go on as long as he did.
Well, you get at all of this through having a story about his nephew who Beethoven gets custody over after the nephew's father dies.
Right.
And it's funny,
like the baby M case.
Right. Well, the nephew's into writing and writing for the stage, and Beethoven thinks that that's really like trashy pop art.
Really prostitutes act. Right, that's right. He had a terrible opinion of all human beings, but when it came to women who weren't entirely well behaved with a title and, you know, up in a house, conducting themselves to all appearances very correctly, he felt they were all diseases. His word, over and over again, he uses this word. He has the terms pestilential breath, fire, breathing dragon. His references to women are rather comical, but he lived in a period which is we're approaching in our own period, which is rather interesting comparison, inevitable comparison, where people were spreading sexually transmitted diseases. Then, more than now, and there's a movie about Mozart that shows him dying in bed, and he doesn't even bother to mention what killed him. You'd have no idea why he's dying, but he died of syphilis. But Beethoven was affected at his death by the pneumonia and cirrhosis of the liver, but the syphilis probably was a factor. But he seems to have inherited the syphilis from his mother without any real contact with other people. So his deafness, which was the infection due to the syphilis, according to medical theory on his case, was, a factor in his phobia against contact with other people.
Okay, well, let's hear a clip from the movie. Let me see if I can set this up. This takes place at a masked ball, and Beethoven wants custody of his nephew, and he's fighting with his nephew's mother. He doesn't want his nephew to see his mother. So they're at this masked ball fighting. As they fight, the nephew is entering the masked ball with a woman, an actress, who is soon to be his lover, played by Natalie Bay.
You slut!
You're mad! Leave me alone! Leave me alone!
Would you believe it? The party has hardly begun and already some drunk. He's starting a fight over some whore.
If you want to leave, let's do it right now, please.
No, let's stay. This might be amusing.
I'm afraid that drunk you're talking about is my uncle.
Oh.
And that whore is my mother.
We just heard Natalie Bay in that clip, and I think a lot of our listeners will know her from her performances in La Balance and The Return of Martin Guerre. Working with an actress like her is really different than working with the more inexperienced actors who you worked with in your early films. Are you more interested now in working with more established actors than you used to?
Working with actors like her is no different than working with inexperienced actors. You work with actors, performers, the same way no matter who they are. You ask them to do something and they do it, and you you say whether they're doing it the way it seems good or the way it doesn't seem good. There's no difference.
Yeah, but I think in your early films you had a real kind of laissez-faire attitude in a way about
I was doing contemporary stories, and I wanted a more contemporary, realistic approach to the way people spoke to one another, and so the things were dialogues were improvised upon a set format and story given to the performers, the actors, and there was a different way of doing it, sure, but I'm dealing with contemporary comedies about life and other things, but those early films utilized an enormous amount of improvised dialogue. This film doesn't. I haven't used improvised dialogue for 15 years.
Now, you're working on another film, too, which will be opening in the near future.
It's called Spike of Bensonhurst. It's about family comedy of teenagers in Brooklyn neighborhoods, dominated the kind of neighborhoods where mafia influence is very strong and where the entire neighborhood is really controlled by the mafia. And it's just a human comedy about families. I mentioned to someone I saw somewhere that it's, in a way, it's no different than Beethoven. It's about the foolish extremes people go to within their own families.
Sylvia Miles is in it. You worked with her.
She's a good actress, very funny.
And
she's a very fine actress, and She knows where the laughs are, and I always like that with an actor.
One last question. Have you looked back at the early films that were just re-released on home video?
Yeah.
How do you think they hold up?
I think they're just as funny today as they were then. I think the foolishness of human personality, which I was looking for then, and I hope I touched upon, is still foolish and funny. I think that if you try to be truthful to human personality, and it's in its rather silly moments, you get something that doesn't age. I think comedies in all film history are the ones that survive the 30 years, the 40 years, the 50 years, even the silent films. It's the comedies of Buster Keaton and people like that that are still watched. Well, the serious films, the dramas, become foolish and, the issue passes. But the issue in comedy is human personality, and that stays the same 50, 80, 100 years later. So I think those films are still funny, and I think they, as a side effect, they seem to represent, I think, a little record of the way people thought and the way they didn't give a damn and the way they thought they could do whatever they wanted and get away with it. And all the time they're doing that, they're making their lives more miserable as they go along. I don't think that's a story that dates so much. So I rather enjoyed them.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
My guest has been film director Paul Morrissey, and three of his early films, produced by Andy Warhol, Heat, Flesh, and Trash, have just been released on home video. His new film, Beethoven's Nephew, will have its U.S. premiere this week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.